Hare Krishna, this is Dhanadhar Swami. With some of you, hello?
Hare Krishna, Baba, this is Atma, what are
you? Okay, I'm here. This morning I have a teacher training. It starts at 9 o'clock. It's a little bit late. So I thought what I can do is, another 5 minutes, just link you up to the teacher training. And, I'm going to be speaking on bhakti. I think you may find it interesting. Yesterday morning, I was at a teacher training in Hudson. It was really wonderful. I did Ancient Teachings, Modern Life, Raghunath's group. A lot of people that I met had come to India with me were in that teacher training. And then drove to New York and went to the Stanton Street Yoga with Butter Ryan and Panchagoda and Rukmini. And they had Kirtan last night. And then Radha Vallabha drove me to New Haven, where he's studying at Yale Divinity. And then so I was only about 35 minutes away, and I came here this morning. I guess they're just settling their group down, and then I'll come in and speak. So I am making that effort to kind of continue the Sangha. This is unusual because it's 9 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and it just corresponds with this. I'll be in Hartford this afternoon after the program. We go from 9 to 12. And if you hang around or just come back in 5 minutes, I should be underway. Anyway, I can talk a little bit. When I did the Ancient Teachings, Modern Life, what I discussed was how the scriptures are in the context of a supportive environment, and how do you practice spiritual life when that supportive environment is not there? So the first point I make is one based on ideals of the scriptures, try to find a supportive environment. Then we went to the point, if our karma doesn't provide a supportive environment, then what to do? And I spoke about, we discussed it with Mahamuni, some of Ramanuja's views of karma yoga and how to see God in the world, which was an interesting discussion for people, how to just perform dharma, do what's right, which is spiritual in every situation. We have a myriad of decisions to make. And then I discussed the power of kirtan as a meditational yoga that transcends environment, because it creates its own environment. And then I discussed especially sadhu sangha, that the main way we advance is linking ourselves up to people who we value. And by appreciating them, serving them, hearing from them, their qualities come to us. And that's the main way in which one advances on the path of bhakti yoga, actually speaking. That's my main inspiration, my main process. Seeking out those people who are advanced and serving them. And then, knowing that sadhu sangha is not always available, we did prayerful reading. And I gave out Beyond Birth and Death, about 25 copies, to the pretty large teacher training. That was kind of interesting. And then they read, basic Sankhya by Prabhupada, then discussed among themselves. Probably my most successful seminar in terms of the response of the people. Really felt it spoke to them, it touched them. And quite a few of them are going to come on Thursday if anybody's around at Yoga Maya. I just want to see if they're waiting for me or if, okay. Okay, I think they're pretty much getting. Okay, you're just setting that up. So, if you just want to stay online, one second. You know, I'm just going to leave the phone open and then just put it on when I begin the thing. So just hang around, okay? As I explained, I'm giving a class today at the yoga teacher training, so you can all listen on. It's very poor reception. The call may drop. Just understand I tried to do my duty. Okay. Let me just take out my notes here. Just say a prayer first, myself. A prayer to the teachers in my lineage and to all the great saints. Om Ajana Timarandasya Yananjana Shalakaya Chaksurim Lutam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vansha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivapade Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I think this is my third or fourth time speaking here. And I've lived in India mostly for the last 36 years in one of its prominent holy places called Vrindavan, which is near Delhi, between Delhi and Agra, about an hour and a half from the Taj Mahal and about 2 hours from Delhi. And it's known as the land of temples, the land of Krishna. And I've been living there 20 years straight. I was living there, and about the last 15 years, I've just spent half my time in America trying to share some of those teachings of Indian spirituality. And I have a list of about 10 seminars I give on all kinds of subjects, from the psychology of karma to the environment on consciousness to forgiveness, to the yoga of drama, spirituality and drama, different subjects. And this time I'm going to talk about bhakti yoga, which is my own tradition, but one of the three main spiritual paths in practices in India, which is karma yoga, the yoga of work, jnana yoga, the yoga of analysis, and the Ashtanga yoga, and what you're doing is in the yoga of analysis. And then there's bhakti yoga and the yoga of devotion. So, and it's become very, very prominent within the yoga world because the main spiritual practice of bhakti yoga is kirtan. And kirtan has become a very, very prominent spiritual practice. And we'll discuss a little bit about that today also. Usually before I begin my classes, I give a test, but it's kind of an interesting test. No one yet has passed the test. And it consists of three questions. And you have to give a yes or no answer. Now, I don't collect it. It's within your own mind. And what happens is if you pass the test and answer yes to all three questions, then you become qualified to sit here, and then I have to sit in the audience. Okay, so the first question is, have you found what you're looking for? Now, someone could say that maybe a week ago or a month ago, they found their soulmate. Or they won the lottery. Or they got the occupational or political position they want. Or something. They could say like that. You could say, yes, I have what I'm looking for. I have the mate I'm looking for, and the have a nice family, and they're all well situated. Yes, 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 I found what I'm looking for. I have the job I want. Now, you know, even to say yes to the first question is very rare. But there are people that could say yes. And they could say they found their spiritual path. They could be religious. They could say they found Jesus. They could have gotten the position they wanted. Okay, let's say you have everything. Then the next question is it eternal? Because if what you're looking for is not eternal, then it's filled with duality. And what's the duality? It means two things. It means happiness and distress. But if you're looking for, really, is something to give you happiness. You see, this term faith in Sanskrit is called shraddha. It's not like I believe, you know, it's not a question I believe or I don't believe. It's what you trust in will lead to sublimity. You trust to a certain degree of happiness and satisfaction, right? That's where your faith lies. The most important thing in terms of the science of happiness is having the proper value system to trust and invest your energy and open your heart to something that will actually satisfy you. That's the most important thing. So, in that regard, if you pick something that just like wealth or which, you know, even in Indian spirituality, you know, you have to satisfy yourself or even go deeper spiritually. So part of the philosophy is getting your desires in an appropriate way. But you just understand it's not the ultimate goal. But you look at this duality, because if you pick something that is temporary, then it's also going to be mixed with a certain level of distress. Excuse me? Hello? Okay. I think you need to sit on a chair, maybe. What?
Why?
Because it'd be easier to be up.
Oh, I'm
okay. Because it's also right in front. Okay. What's the duality? The duality is you're going to lose what you value, and therefore, as much pleasure it gives you, it will give you an equal amount of pain. And if it's there now, the fact that you will lose it will give you a certain bit of fear. And eventually you will lose it. And because you lose it, then there's some type of anxiety there. There's some kind of duality. So then the second question, is it eternal? And then you may have said, yes, I found yoga. And yoga is a spiritual path to help us realize something that is eternal. Right? Suffering in the Yoga Sutras is defined as pure, eternal, blissful self identifies with the temporary, impure, suffering mind and body. But you may have said, I found my path, I found some type of something. So you may, yes, some people may still be in the running for the seat. Okay, yes, yes. And the third question is, are you always with it? Are you always living in it? Are you always realizing it? And very few people could say yes, because in the yogic path, that's actually the perfectional state. That you're aware of your spiritual nature. In terms of yoga philosophy, basically all problems are ultimately, existentially, all problems. Thank you so much. Okay. Okay. Okay, I'll pass it out. Thank you so much, Paul. It's more a matter of perception than actuality. In other words, our problems are not actually what exists, it's what we're perceiving to exist. I mean, before I want to discuss bhakti, which is one of the yogas, I want to give a core understanding of what yoga is. For example, when I go to India, the custom is when you go to a holy place, you first bathe in the holy river. So I usually do that. Even coming, I fly into Delhi, and then it takes 2.5 hours to get to Vrindavan. And then even before I go to my place, I have the driver drop me off by the river. And in India, the rivers have these ghats. It's like stone steps into the water. And they may extend, for blocks, miles. So I got out and I started to walk to go bathe. And then I saw on the step, I saw a snake down on one of the steps. And it was black. Black snakes indicate more poisonous. So I'm not used to snakes. Not even used to trees. Grew up in Brooklyn. There's a famous book about Brooklyn, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. You ever read that book? It means it was a big event. So I'm not like a camper or a forest guy at all. You know what I'm saying? So, and it creates a certain nature. So, a nature to be not so comfortable in nature. I didn't feel, oh, wow, look, cool. So I walked down a few blocks, not a few blocks, a couple of, maybe 150 yards. Then I went to bathe. Then I got out. And then when I walked back, I saw the snake, and it was in the same place. Of course, I'm not wearing my glasses at the time because, for many reasons, I'm not wearing the glasses because in this particular place, plus I'm bathing, but also in this place, the monkeys take the glasses right off your head. No. So I don't. and then they'll only give it back to you with bananas. It's just this one place, no other place, but right at this place I know. And I've many, many times, even my glasses are a little chewed here at the end. So I look, boy, it's in the same place, and I look, and I look, and I look, and then I realize it was just a black broken tire. So I was in anxiety, I was in fear, but what was the cause of my fear or anxiety? My perception, not actually what was there. Another example is I may, you know, fall asleep. By God's grace, I'm healthy. That's a good karma that I have. I have other karmas that are not so good. But that one, I'm healthy. And so if I went to sleep and I had a dream that I was sick or ill with some terrible disease, then my problem wouldn't be what was actually there, but what my perception was of it. And the solution would be to get a clear perception by waking up. So this is basically the concept. It's not that if someone is not sick, it's not a problem, but it's not an existential problem. It's not the real problem. In Bhagavad Gita, it says, a popular Indian text, what Bhagavad Gita says, is that when it describes quality of knowledge, one of the qualities of knowledge is janma, mityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, dosha, nidarshanam. That one who has knowledge sees that what are the real problems of life? The real problems of life. It's birth, death, disease, and old age. You have to solve these problems, right? Not it's a geographical problem. You move someplace else. You get a higher position. You have to solve these problems, and the solution to these problems is a spiritual solution, realizing something that's beyond the temporary mind and body. And that's what the purpose of yoga is. The purpose of yoga is to deal with the mind, actually. In Indian philosophy, there are six schools of Indian philosophy. Traditionally, there are six schools. And they divided it up in that way. It's not there originally in the original text, but later scholars have saw. And there are six schools that are six categories that basically are inclusive of any other conception or thought. There's Sankhya, which is philosophical analysis. There's Nyaya, which is logic. There is Vedanta, which is scriptural analysis. There is Vaisheshika, which is basically material science. And there's yoga. And yoga is basically the science of psychology. It's basically what yoga means is the science of how to deal with the mind. And the first understanding of the mind is what the mind is. The mind is an instrument. The mind is a lens. And the nature of this lens is for the lens to be functional. It must be clean and undistorted. When you have the lens in the proper position, then what happens is you able to see things properly. And by seeing things properly, you actually solve your problems. And what is the main problem? The main problem is death. What can be a greater problem than non-existence? There's even a philosopher, his name Ernest Becker. He wrote a book called Denial of Death. And he showed that a lot of our psychological movements, our psychological aberrations,
how we act, what we do, is denying death and trying to establish something beyond death, like a lineage, a family, a mark in the world, a reputation, a literary work. And it affects us so deeply psychologically. But we understand, the first thing we understand in yoga philosophy is that death is the illusion of non-existence. If you think that one day you will not exist, you are not seeing what's there, which is your eternal nature. I'm just giving what the philosophy is. You can accept it or not, but I'm just representing the yoga tradition. That non-existence actually is an illusion, that you'll become one day non-existent. But because you're not seeing the self, illusion means what? You're not seeing what's there. What's there is a spiritual entity that exists beyond the body. And the other aspect of illusion is you're seeing something that's not there. What? The body and mind as the self. See, and someone who is in this tradition, they consider, who becomes self-realized, actually sees the soul, and he is not at all bewildered by death or disturbed by it or afraid of it because it doesn't exist. I was there when my teacher, who is a renowned saint and spiritual luminary. I was there in the room when he left. Actually, I was there when he came back to the holy place, even his body, and to die. And we went in the room, and they looked at us. He said, "What is death but a change of body?" And then he quoted the Gita. He said, "The Heino Smid, Yata Dehe, Komaran Yovanam Jara, Yata Dehe." As the embodied soul passes from boyhood, from childhood, to youth, to old age, similarly the time of death, doesn't accept another body, one who is seen. Okay, I'm back here. You can hear now, Gail? Are you on? Anybody on?
We can hear you. We can hear you, Marlowe. Thank you.
Okay.
We can hear you now.
Okay. I told them that, they said, no, we want to hear. The lady who called up hasn't missed a class in 6 years. She's very dedicated to hearing. And so the Dalai Lama, when he came into the, he came in and he, they showed him the view of the Alps. They said, well, isn't that nice? He said, well, if I was depressed, it would look like a good place to jump. You see, because it's a question of perception, right? It's a question of perception. Same thing, looked at in a different way, causes a different effect of happiness and distress. And what does depression mean in terms of yoga psychology? I'll make it simple. The mind is very malleable. The mind is very, very malleable. It just, it can change its shapes rapidly according to the environment you're in. You're in the country, it can kind of open up to more goodness or something. You know, you go to a bar, it may close a little bit in terms of the perception. You get drunk. So basically, there's three shapes. Basically, there's this goodness where you're actually, it's prakash, light. You see things very, very clearly. If you're in goodness, you can meditate very, very clearly. You can see things, you can smell things, you can taste things. Right? Like in the morning time is in goodness. And if you walk outside, you're this happiness. You can hear the birds, you can see things. So it's happiness, it's contentment, it's perception, it's illumination, it's peacefulness. Then this would be passion. In Sanskrit, that's called rajagun, gunas, modes. The mind is in this shape, intense desire. You want more and better and more and more and more, and there's restlessness. Restlessness is kind of like a static. When you want to meditate, if you're restless, it's very, very difficult. And then there's the mode of ignorance. It means no activity, no light. It's depression. And if you're seeing the world through the lens of the mind that's contracted to that type of shape, then it may be beautiful, but you don't see it that way. You see it as no value. So how does the mind, you know, assume the various shapes? A lot of things is the environment. For example, the sounds. There are sounds in ignorance, and they'll move the mind that way. There are sounds in passion. That's why in the military, you know, they have a band. It really changes the mind of the people to be passionate, which you need for war. Dun, 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 dun. Ignorance, passion, goodness, different modes. And so the environment, all the shapes, the sounds, the things you feel, smell, they're in these modes. It's a whole science. And the actions that you perform. And there's different factors, but that's it. So it and yoga means what? To stop the vrittis. What are the vrittis? They're the transformations of the mind, the anxieties and thoughts, the selfishness, the anxieties, the selfishness. They're constantly distorting the mind and distorting our perception. And therefore, what is the yogic process traditionally? I'll first speak of my tradition, bhakti, in terms of classical yoga, and then probably say a little bit more about it. But what is it? There's Ashtanga yoga. There's eight practices of controlling the mind, and they're progressive. There's yam. What does yam mean? Yam means how you control the mind in relationship to others. If you can't control the mind in relationship to others, you cannot begin yoga. And the first yam is ahimsa. If you exploit others, you have absolutely no control of your mind. There's no question of a clear perception of reality when you are harming others. So, you know, there's different yams, you know, how you deal with yourself, including truthfulness, non-stealing, basic things. Can't be a yogi. Then yam niyam, how you deal with others, niyam, how you deal with yourself. Which includes some regulation of the sexual impulse, which includes cleanliness, and Ishvara Pranidhan, which means also to worship the divine, how you deal with yourself. Then there's asana. And asana is the part of yoga that's probably stressed the most, because if the body is not healthy, you can't control the mind. And it says yoga means two things. Asana is for sthira and sukha. It means to become steady and happy in the body. That's what the practice is. If you're not steady and happy in the body, right, you're trying to meditate. And then there's pranayama. The breath is connected to the mind. And then there's pratyahara. Then you really execute extreme self-discipline, extracting the mind. And then after that, that's when meditation begins, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. And then you enter into this space above all the distractions and the and you kind of live in another space. You really live in this. Okay, you know what I think I'm, What I think I'll do with the class here, we'll divide it into three parts, and we'll take three short breaks. The first part is almost to be finished, and that's classical yoga. Then I'll discuss bhakti, and then we'll do some bhakti meditation and bhakti practice. So the last part will be actually very, very practical. So that's controlling the mind. And what's the recommendation of controlling the mind in classical yoga is there's these vrittis, and it's creating this incredible static, right? And different types of moods. And according to the different types of moods, our perceptions are changing. The same things are there, but we're having a different level of happiness and distress. So what happens is, what yoga does, basically speaking, it says you take one thing to think of, and if you can concentrate on one thing, and we'll also do classical meditation according to the Yoga Sutras. If you meditate on one thing, then what will happen is all the other vrittis will be subdued. And the mind will start to evolve to a higher level of perception and contentment. And basically, in the classical meditation, you can meditate on anything. But I'm going to also discuss through the Yoga Sutras. Probably better, we'll just divide the class in half. I think that's a better thing. So I'll go another 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll take a little break. So what happens is that we focus on one thing, you know, it just, the mind evolves to a higher level of perception. That's the classical yoga practice. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? Yes.
Control of the mind. Yeah. What's coming to mind is to strengthen
the mind. It's actually the same thing. To control the mind or strengthen the mind. Yeah. What is a strong mind? A mind which you have control over. Right. And a strong mind would really have two aspects: the ability to appropriately open your heart and express emotions, right? You can see when someone has a strong mind, they don't have inhibitions to like open their heart, you know, and to be able to check your emotions when they're inappropriate. You know, that's what a strong mind is. And just in terms of yoga psychology, the way a strong mind is created is generally with the impressions you get in youth, when you're young. A strong mind is generally created by parents who give an appropriate level of affection and set reasonable boundaries, affection. Because if the affection is there, then it gives a certain hope in the heart, which one accesses that allows them to open it. So people with a strong mind, and that's that they can open the heart, or they can be very disciplined. Mind, but it's the mind that's controlled. If the emotions are just all over the place, then there's anger. Then there's affection to the point of spoiling someone, you know, or there's no affection when affection should be given. The mind is uncontrolled. Yeah. Other questions? Go ahead.
Yeah. I work in a demographic, and there's a lot of angry young kids.
Yeah.
They don't have parents.
Yeah.
Both of
yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
And that's actually part of the reason why I'm here.
Yeah.
Just to be encouraged to do that.
Yeah.
To get rid of the anger.
Yeah.
But being one person, having 286 kids, I'm kind of overwhelmed.
Right. Well, I do have to admire your compassion, which is a really good quality. Spiritual life has to begins when you start to think of others before yourself. But at the same sense, you have to realize that your ability to control the world is also limited. In Bhagavad Gita, it says there's five factors of action to influence things, only one is the endeavor. So what you have to do basically is do what you can according to your duty in the situation, and then you have to leave the rest to God and the way destiny pans out. Just try your best. But you should not be angry or frustrated yourself if something is beyond your own capacity to change. But you should try something effective. If yoga exercise itself it could have a transformatory effect on even troubled people, you know, because they could, you know, perhaps experience a little relief from controlling the mind away. But probably, you know, they need those two things, which they probably didn't get in their life, which is affection and boundaries. So you don't get enough affection, you're subject to depression. If you don't get enough boundaries, you're subject to anxiety. Because your world, when you grow up in a world that's set reasonably, you know, the parents set a world with reasonable values, and you live in another world, you're not negotiating it minute by minute. So there's a certain security, there's a certain stability. And if you don't have that, then your world is changing as a young child every minute, according to your whims, according to what you can do, what you can control, what you can manipulate. So you develop impressions in mind that cause a lot of deep anxiety, just by nature. Anyway, I empathize with you, and I don't know what the limits of what you can do and what you can even introduce according to your job. But pick up all this knowledge. I have a website, wavesofdevotion.com, and if you look at the article, I wrote one article on yoga psychology, which from the Yoga Sutras outlines kind of a paradigm for how the mind works. And I think it would be helpful how the mind works. You can understand how you can change it. I think it's very profound, not what I wrote, but what the Yoga Sutras say about the mind. And really understand any psychological process or self-improvement process, you can understand how habits are formed, how psychological aberrations are things, just by how the mind is. Yes?
Speaking of children, do you have any recommendations on how to up their self-confidence? Because that obviously has a lot to
do
with the mind.
Right.
And their upbringing.
Yeah, well, I mean, two things. One, I'm kind of letting the class go a little bit. I hope people don't know much. You know, the topic I haven't got to, but if this works for the class and you're interested, because I've studied a lot of things, I've also was a teacher. I also studied children and a psychology. It's, you know, the problem with children when they grow up, what I see is a child's psychology is that a child wants to learn. They want to learn, and that's where they're happy. And not only do they want to learn, they want to do what adults do. So generally, when a child, the proper way to give a child self-confidence when they're young, parents set boundaries, which are very, very rigid, but they're broad. And within those boundaries, the child is allowed to explore. that's why, you know, urban environments are not so urban, because they you know, they need a big backyard where they can put things in their mouth and look at things and touch things. And when the mother has to always go, whoop, you know, completely grabbing the child at every moment, keeping them close, being the only one with the child, there's also a problem with the nuclear family. And it doesn't mean the family that explodes like the honeymooners. It means, you know, just husband. It's a lot of problem because it really, in a proper family, you know, there should be a community, you know, where the child enters. And, you know, when a child enters a nuclear family, all of a sudden he becomes the center and the world is dictated by their desires. And then you spend the rest of your years with the child trying to get them out of that conception. When they're in a community, it's too big and too strong and on the parent's attachment to this, to set what the world is. The child grows up in another world. This, because it's a community, they get maximum affection. Basically, you know, modern world, you know, it's made some advancements and a lot of things backwards in terms of tradition and culture, especially in terms of child rearing. So how to give children confidence? Well, I think one thing I would say, there's three things. There's recognition of talent. There's facilitation of one's talents, and then there's certain types of boundaries that enable the child to work within a social structure. So what's disempowering is when there's only the rules. You can't go here, you can't do this, and you're not this, and you're not qualified this, and what happens if this happens, and don't go here, and don't do this, you know. But if you look at someone and say, wow, this is what you can do, right? And then you facilitate it. I know one family, you know, the child was a dancer, right? The child was a dancer and, you know, it was ballet. But then the mother decided, the child got a little injury and said, you know, well, you know, it's too hard and it's too difficult and, you know, it takes too much time, you know? And then I saw what happened with the child is they became depressive, you know, because they didn't have their passion. You understand? It was always about, you know, so I think what you have to do is you have to find a child's passion. Everyone has a quality in which they're supposed to add to the world. And I think you have to find the child's passion, and, you know, and that's empowering. You can do this. Find out what it is. And then the parent has to facilitate it. Then they set the boundaries. You know, you can do this, but you have to, you know, be home at 7 and do your homework. You know, you can do this, but, you know, do it on these days. So I would say, and the thing in myself, working with organizations and things like that, you know, frustrating when people are disempowering, when all they see is how you fit into the structure. Well, you can't do this here, and you can't do this here, and you can't do this here. That comes the third thing after you say, this is who you are, this is what you can accomplish, this is what you can do, you know, but here are the boundaries. Okay, if everybody's okay with this.
Yeah.
What?
Okay. That's why we're here.
Okay.
I have something non-child related.
Okay, yeah.
You say that.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
The problem, the ultimate concern.
Yeah.
Death.
Yeah.
Accepting death, happening
yeah.
with penalties,
yeah.
is a process.
Yeah.
So you can get to the point in your life from your practice, your experiences, from
yeah.
your teacher,
yeah.
where, okay, well, whatever, it happens, it's heavy deal, so it's not a focus in your everyday life. You
yeah.
go about
yeah.
being.
Yeah.
So when it comes back to your forefront of your mind and you're
yeah.
constantly harping on it, jumps
yeah.
into your mind and the weirdest of situations, oh, God, death,
yeah.
you start to freak out. What's happening? And how can you pull yourself back to where death is not in the forefront of your mind? Because in our world, it's like, oh, you must need a Prozac or Zoloft. Death is absolute preconceptions of death and thinking about death is a psychological issue with medicine. Where did the person go wrong or lose something in their journey that made these things come back to the forefront of their mind?
You mean death? Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, in the Yoga Sutras, it also mentions that, you know, we're transmigrating, from body to body to body to body. We're transmigrating. And why is a child afraid of death? They haven't had any experience. They haven't seen it. Because in the past life, they died. And the impression of that was so powerful that it stays within the consciousness. You understand? So it is a very, very real thing. It shows, actually, the fear of death shows that there's actually transmigration of the soul from body to body. Because where would that fear come from? It comes from that experience that we had. So it's very, very real. But the impetus for it is that we're actually supposed to develop the understanding of the spirit. I'll give you an example. You know, we all go through these trials in life, these tribulations in life, and we're limited in our enjoyment because we're not controlling the world. And sometimes, you know, and what's happiness? This is my desire, and this is how I want the world to go, right? But the world sometimes moves very, like we want to go this way, and the world's going this way, and there's calamities and there's tragedies. And I was going through one of these things, you know, and I deeply took shelter of spiritual activities in my tradition, chanting mantras, which are an expression of one's relationship with God, and it's an experience of God. And I'm entering into that space of the soul, it just in a sense of accessing that sense of me. And then I had this sense, yes, these spiritual activities that are based on the core experience of the soul of altruism and selflessness and service and worship of God, that does not end because that's me. That's actually me. So I had a kind of relief at that sense. Yes, what I'm doing now, these spiritual activities, they continue beyond the body. So I think the only recourse in getting free from death, at least I'm presenting the yoga tradition, is to have some type of practice or some type of spiritual practice where you're concentrating on the nature of the soul and the eternal aspect of it. And to the extent you realize that is the extent that you become free from fear. I remember when I was 6 years old, five years old, growing up in Brooklyn, I don't know where it came from. I was a little child, and I began to think of the future. Right? I began to think of the future. And when I began to think of the future, it was okay, now I'll be like 20, like my, you know, older cousin or my, you know, this, and I'll be like my parent. And then somehow it went to death, and I became afraid. And I realized then when I met a spiritual tradition that talked to me, and our tradition is not sectarian in the sense that when you define religion or spirituality, it's not a particular faith. It's the nature of your soul. The nature of your soul, what you are, is that you're a part of the divine and you're meant for service. That's what religion is. That's what spirituality is. It's not a particular shape that it comes in. So what happened was, is when I came to the tradition, when I was 19, I'm 60... over 61 now. When I was 19, I came to this kind of, and I got this kind of even theoretical spiritual knowledge that I am eternal. I remember it was like taking a rock off my head. You know, kind of like the existentialists. You know, they carry this existential malaise, this rock. And what's the rock? The rock is that they actually believe that death is the end of existence. And you know, the you may not be agree with existentialists, but they are honest philosophers. They at least have integrity for what they believe. Therefore, they think of suicide, they think of, you know, they think life has no value because that's what their conception or value is, that it all ends. you know. So it depends. If you have some spiritual conceptions, it's an amazing thing about America, of all countries, you know, because I've experienced this, is not maybe overtly an external practice, but compared to Europe and things like that. You know, Americans, I don't know, they're blessed with some kind of spirituality, no matter where they are. Americans believe in some type of spiritual existence much more than other people. Even I was in Italy. I just came from Italy. And, you know, they were translating and telling me what words I could use, you know. Yeah, so, okay. So, what we'll do now is we did about half. And what I think we can do now is just take a break for about 5 or 10 minutes. Then I'll begin to explain the relationship to bhakti and types of classical yoga, describe bhakti, and go. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Thank you so much. This is like a good start here. Okay. Let's start again at 10:30. What time do you have now? What? What?
10:15.
Oh, it's only 10:15. No. We'll start in 10 minutes, 10:25, and then I broke a little early, but this is when I finished. Okay?
Thank you.
What's that? If you want, we'll do. Okay. Well, thank you for the feedback. I needed that too. I don't know what the people's frame of reference
is. We have trainees from their first day of class all the way trainees that are in the 500 hours.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. This is good because I broke now.
Yeah.
And I broke out.
Yeah.
I see you're enjoying.
I want to jump in it.
Okay.
It's so easy to get off coffee.
Okay. It's early in the morning.
Yeah.
How you doing?
Morning.
Okay. How are you, Perez? All right. Good. Studying yoga?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I'm right here. I'm a teacher over at River Rock Yoga, so I'm trying to pursue my $500 training.
Wow.
Go a little deep and get rid of some of that ricky.
Okay.
Looks like you're in good shape. Is that your main work, or you do your...
I'm a construction
worker. Yeah. Okay. And then you get to do the yoga and...
Yeah. Wonderful.
Okay. I studied martial arts previously.
All good disciplines.
Okay.
In classical yoga, you're meditating. It's always done in the cross legged lotus position.
Yeah.
So it's not so much being comfortable. It's developing that.
Well, that is comfortable.
Okay.
Unless you can be comfortable in that pose, you're not going to be comfortable meditating. So you have to. It may be a struggle, but that's the beginning. You have to get comfortable in that kind of pose.
Hello.
Thank you.
I'm Christina. Nice
okay,
to meet
Maraj.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm really enjoying the lecture.
Okay. It's a challenge because I'm not really aware what the students know, don't know.
Right.
So I'm trying to keep open and sensitive to it. And I figured starting with just a classical basic conception of yoga, then we can fit bhakti in there.
Right. Well, I'm taking a Hinduism class at my school, so we just talked about like classical yoga and things going to get like a different interpretation. I mean, it's not that much different, though.
It shouldn't be different because I studied the Yoga Sutras extensively.
Right.
And that's the basis of what yoga
is. No, it's interesting.
And sometimes people who are in the academy are not really scholars of the tradition.
Right.
That makes sense.
Okay.
But it's very interesting.
Okay. Good. I want to satisfy everyone for what they've come for.
Right.
I think you are.
Okay.
I think people don't realize that everything has to. Some people don't realize everything has to come out. It's all connected.
Yeah.
So no matter where the discussion goes, it's all the same thing. The basic concept and the basic concept.
Yeah.
And that's being very...
Yeah, well, different people have different desires, different needs, what they want. But, no, I have definitely have a general conception of where I'm going. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? There's a limit to how far it can go, but...
Yeah, because it's a very short time in which to try to express everything that needs to be expressed.
Right, which where I need feedback, which is... Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, good. We'll do something. Okay.
How long are you
in Connecticut? Just till tomorrow. Actually, I did a teacher training in Hudson, New York yesterday, and then went down to Manhattan last night for a friend of mine opened a yoga school, was having kirtan.
Oh.
And then I came here last night from that with a friend who's studying at Yale Divinity School. And then I came here this morning. And then there's a Hartford, a Krishna Hartford temple in East Hartford. I'll probably go there. And then tomorrow I'll go upstate where I kind of base myself for a couple of days, and I'll go back to the city and teach. I teach in New York City a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, connected with various yoga studios.
I was just down in West Virginia over my spring break, and we went to a Krishna temple in Wheeling, I think it was. Maybe not Wheeling, but it was in West Virginia.
Yeah.
Wheeling. It was just very interesting.
Oh, they had that Palace of Gold thing?
Mm-hmm, the Palace of Gold, exactly.
Okay.
It was beautiful.
Yeah, it was all made by the people there.
Right.
By hand.
I was just amazed that it was just in the middle of nowhere, up in the hills, and never know that it would be found there.
It started about 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and people didn't have much money, so they wanted to buy land. Like, you know, kind of big, like for $3,
okay.
you get 10 acres in West Virginia, and that's what happened.
Wow.
And my teacher went there, and he liked it, because
mm-hmm.
he thought that for spirituality, you should have simple living and high thinking.
Right.
Wow.
So.
It is very simple living.
Yeah.
Our culture thinks we should have more things. And
yeah, well, I mean, we have faith in Facebook. People think we can get happiness. What? I someone does it for me. I don't personally go on, although I feel everything has a utility, but it has a certain energy that it could be anti-yoga. That can kind of, what?
Well, I've been writing poetry in a really long time, and your irony of your cell phone.
Huh?
Yeah.
I shot it with the cell phone. Okay. Okay.
No, but I appreciated that. I don't have a facility. I was reading one of those National Nutmeg magazines that there's a life coach, Yogi, that does all of her work on Skype.
Yeah.
And so she does her life work on her own, and then we'll Skype
it. It can be used. It can be used. Things happen. Very good.
You know, I found it in one of those little boxes.
Swami means master. So Swami means you should be master of the senses. So in Indian culture, a Swami would be one who takes vows of celibacy. There's a certain order of that. In our tradition, you can become a priest whether you're married or celibate. But they also have provisions if people have that proclivity. It's generally not recommended.
Oh, no.
The bhakti is about dedication. It doesn't really matter what your attachments are, where you are. You just give yourself.
So you travel
I lived in India for many years in one place, 20 years.
Yeah.
Is this all 500 hours? Or
no, this is some 200 hours.
Yeah, me too.
when Paula walked in here, our room must have been a lot warmer. I mean, I was comfortable.
Yeah. Consciousness will come to you.
I think I'm far too sensitive. I'm one of those sensitive.
Right. So
I'm not like absorbing it all, and I just
you got to be careful. You got to be careful. You take this. Yeah.
Oh, and you said so. I appreciate.
Yeah.
I know it wasn't exactly the course outline, but it could have profound. Significance, and I am making my decision. If I'm going to get it or not, I'm going to go back one more time and give it my shot. And
be detached. Do your duty, but don't have expectations beyond your duty. Let God get the results.
I thought I didn't realize he is looking for me.
I feel it now. You can't
say
anything. Okay.
Okay, I think we should settle back now. Okay. You can hand these out here. Okay, should we start again? It'd be kind of nice to do that. We can hand these out. You can get one of these, and I'll tell you what it is.
We have another person.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Can I take a few of them, and I'll hand them?
Yeah, that would be very nice. Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay. Okay. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Okay. Okay, we'll start now. I'll just kind of made the halfway mark with people still interested, thank you. Hope so. This I'm actually writing a book, and I wait a second. I'm not even sure. Oh. Okay, that may be good. Well, I kind of made a mistake when I gave it. That's only the first verse. But what I'll do at the end, if someone's really interested, they can get the second and third verse. What this is one of the main Bhakti books is called the Narada Bhakti Sutras, and I'm writing a commentary on it. So this hasn't been published. This is the commentary on the first verse. And a sutra is a very interesting thing. In all those schools that we're talking about, they generally have a sutra, and it begins with a ta, now. It means, you know, this is significant, this is important,
this is urgent to take to this path, and then they explain what that path is. So a sutra is a code. It's very, very terse, just a few words, and they're usually understood with commentaries. So the Yoga Sutras, you know, they're only like 800 words or 1,000 words. So they put a lot, pack a lot of meaning into a little. And then someone makes a commentary and he expands that a bit. So that's what I'm doing, trying to help people understand in a contemporary way what is bhakti. Now, in terms of yoga, okay, this verse here says, atato bhakti akyashmaha. It says, now I will explain the process of bhakti. So, in terms of a classical type of meditation, you can meditate on one thing. Right, that's it, whatever it is. And it'll work. If we did a meditation and just concentrated on the breathing, it will work to a certain degree. And the efficacy of the meditation is to the degree that you can remain absorbed. Now, the highest stage of yoga is called samadhi. The highest stage are called dharana, dhyana, samadhi. And but the person, they're fixed in meditation. And when they're fixed in meditation, all these other thoughts, they're